Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. And what if I told you there's a performance-enhancing drug that's completely free, completely legal, and has no ill side effects when used correctly? Oh, and you've probably already taken it many times in your life. Well, that drug is competition. And today on the show, I talked to author Poe Bronson about his book Top Dog that digs deep into the science of competition and how it can improve our performance in a wide variety of tasks. In today's podcast, Poe and I discuss the difference between adaptive and maladaptive competition, that's good and bad competition, the culture of virtuous competition that existed amongst the ancient Greeks, and how you can shape competition to make you a better man in all aspects of your life. Really interesting show. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/topdog. Poe Bronson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you co-authored a book a few years ago called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which is all about the research about what competition, how it influences performance, what it does to our biology, our psychology. But let's start off with this, because you argue in the book that competition has all these enormous benefits that come with improving performance, but it seems like these days competition has sort of a PR problem. I mean, there's this ethos in public schools and in public life that, you know, cooperation beats competition. So why does competition seem to have this PR problem these days?
The fact that it has a PR problem is a lot of why we were motivated to work on the book in the first place. And we felt a significant disconnect between what the scientific research was saying and this default thinking about competition. And one of the things that is there is just as we wanted to emphasize throughout our society that teamwork is important. And we recognize that the kids that we're educating are going to have to grow up and work largely in teams. Not all of them, but the vast majority of them. We've also kind of misread why children misbehave, and we think that superiority rings of competition, and we just didn't parse these things correctly. Just for the most fundamental aspect, think of it this way. Like, what's the most famous example? It would be you're on a sports team. You're competing while you're cooperating, right? When you're on a team working for your company, what are you doing? You're competing with other companies in the marketplace. Your team is up against other teams. Cooperation and teamwork are integral to competition, not divergent from competition. In fact, just delve quickly into the science, we fundamentally get this wrong, that the hormone of cooperation is actually the very same hormone as the hormone of competition, which is testosterone. And there's this great study where these neuroscientists would have women come into the lab and they would play, economic type games where you can either at a certain point in the game, share the winnings with your partner or steal all the winnings at the end of this little economic game. And before they played, these women were told they'd be given a little flask and drink it, and they would be told, you've either been given a testosterone, or you've been given this other chemical that we're not going to tell you yet. And after they played, they asked the women, what did they think? What had they, you played the game a certain way. You stole from your opponent, or you shared with your opponent. What hormone do you think you were given? And the women who stole from their opponent, they all assumed, I must have been given testosterone. And the women who shared with their opponent said, I must have been given this magical chemical. What is it? I really want it. But in fact, it was exactly the other way around. The women who had been given testosterone shared with their opponent. The women who stole from their opponent had actually just been given a placebo. They'd been given nothing. And that testosterone was driving cooperation, not stealing from your opponent. Because to be a good teammate in a competitive setting, you really got to be fine-tuned to this. And if they do these studies of college soccer teams and they rate them on, 15 matrix assessments for how good are they, really a team player, like, do their eyes glance over their shoulder and spot their team, and how do they modulate the tone of their voice to communicate well. And what they also check testosterone levels as they rise and vary from a day before the competition to pre-competition to during the competition to after. And what they found is that the athletes whose testosterone goes up are better team players. Not, and it's just, we've just have this thing dead wrong. I'll let you ask me a question again, Brett. Sorry to rip off there, but I care a lot about this, and it bums me out that we're just have this point of view that is just wrong. It's not just wrong, like philosophically wrong or analytically wrong. It's like scientifically wrong. Biologically wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. I think that's counterintuitive for a lot of people. Like you said, most people think testosterone is this sort of rage-inducing hormone that makes you selfish and overly aggressive, but the research indicates otherwise. And we'll get more into the physiology of competition, and including testosterone, some of the other neurotransmitters and hormones that are involved in the competitive process. But do you think another reason why there's a PR problem with competition is that we are using the word competition to define two types of competition? I think in the book you talk about there's adaptive competition and maladaptive competition.
Yeah, that's a really good insight, Brett, that we use one word to describe two different things, and we don't parse them and separate them. We do understand we have this bad, we have this term for, what does being a bad sport mean? And so we recognize these differences, but we think that somehow it's fundamental to competition. Certain competitions can give rise to lots of cheating. Certain competitions can give rise to poor performance. The vast majority of competition, especially if it's well-structured, gives rise to increased performance, to good sportsmanship. The ancient Greeks, Ashley, my co-author, and I were kind of just fascinated because we were just brainstorming. We're like, what is ancient Greece known for? Well, it's known for two things. It's known for the Olympics, and it's known for giving us democracy. And then we were like, I wonder, is there a connection between those two in any way? They both seem to be ancient Greece. Ancient Greece was a certain period of time. And so we looked it up. Interestingly, the ancient Olympics were at first a religious festival. And a truce was part of this, because to travel across each other's lands, they needed to have a truce, and they came together. And as it grew in its popularity, and these different sultans and kings of different regions would come to attend this religious ceremony, it began to be a question, well, who gets to light that fire that starts this religious ceremony. And so they decided, we'll have a foot race. It was a 200-yard-long foot race. And everybody put up their best athlete to race in this foot race, and somebody won. And then this religious fest slowly merged into what we know of as the Olympics. And as the Olympics ensued, it wasn't just like the athletes who went to Athens to compete. It was actually a whole posse, right? Like the king and his philosophers and his poets and slaves and his warriors the warriors were often the people who were the athletes. And they would come a month ahead of time and they would train. They would train for the Olympics. So all these philosophers and poets were hanging out and they were watching these athletes transform their bodies through training. And as they watched it, they began to think and discuss amongst each other, you know, it's interesting because we have this philosophy of, say, somebody from an upper caste or an upper class person is better than a lower class person. But look at this lower class soldier who's transforming his body. Maybe we have this wrong. Maybe you can transform your mind. Maybe these people ought to have a voice. They ought to have essentially a vote. And in this way, the origins of democracy were exactly fostered in that month of training for the Olympics, that the Olympics gave rise to democracy itself. And they loved good sportsmanship. And the Greeks were already always into these games and little competitions with checkers and bones and card games and variations of that kind of stuff. And they loved these sports. And there are these famous statues that they're kind of gone now, but you can find photos of them that are sort of replicas. They were called the Zanes. And there were some wrestlers that cheated. And they rigged matches in about the 400s BC or something like that. And the ancient Greeks immortalized those wrestling cheaters with statues outside of the Olympic stadium. And they were there, stood there, you know, for a thousand or years or so before they sort of fell. But imagine that. Imagine if rather than debating whether somebody was to get into, say, our baseball Hall of Fame or football Hall of Fame, instead we actually immortalized them as cheaters outside of the Hall of Fame. So they got a spot at the Hall of Fame just on the outside. The ancient Greeks really understood this difference between adaptive and maladaptive competition. It was deeply imbued into their philosophy, and they had specific different words for both types, and we've lost that as a society today.
Yeah, and what's interesting too, you highlighted the book, is that they didn't just compete over sports. They competed at the Olympics. There was like poetry competitions or oratory competitions. Even their political process was competitive. You try to joust to be the best oratician, best rhetorician. And there was competition, like people judged each other by that. But in the end, it sort of produced this sort of flourishing, as they would call it, this excellence because of it.
Right. The goal of competition was not winning itself. Competition was a process that makes you better. And to be clear, it's not just like when we say that, even listeners might go, "Hey, wait a minute. Think about it calmly here. Competition makes us better. The first and biggest ingredient is that training, right? Knowing that people have to compete, they train, and they get better through the training, even if in the actual event itself, they may do well or do poorly, whatever it is. If just to bring that back to, you know, say where we started with like kids in our modern society, scholars will begin to study things like, say, math competitions. And what they've found is that even kids whose parents sign them up for the math contest or the math club and they don't like math, but their parents sort of forced them to do it, come out of it really enjoying it and learning way more math than they would have in regular class. And it's largely because it's a team environment. You're part of a team. You don't want to let your team down. So you're, in addition to your intrinsic drive to say be good at math, which they may not have, they have this social drive to support their team and not let their team down. And they train. They get better. And even if in that moment of competition they don't win or whatever, they still come away with a really good experience. And they don't feel like a loser because they lost. They're very aware that they got a lot better. And in fact, the scholars who've been doing this research have begun to look across all sorts of other competitions in schools. And there is quite a significant movement akin to, say, how startup competitions to have weekend-long accelerators where you have a challenge and over the course of the weekend you come up with ideas and you draw on resources and by Sunday you make pitches and some people get funding. In a similar way, this sort of gamified academic competitions are really successful, and most interestingly and most effectively, they're used in actually driving the teaching of creativity. So in the science of creativity, we are learning that, yes, some people's brains are more naturally adapted to it than others, just like a basketball player might. It helps to be tall in basketball. But everybody can get better at basketball, and everybody can get better at being creative, and especially means to not just teach it as an art form, but to teach creativity in the sciences and to teach it in history classes and to use competitions. And sort of short-term academic competitions are really successful at driving up motivation, engaging young learners, and getting students to really internalize what they're learning, have some drive. Not that you want to do it every day, but it really works. And I think the key thing here about competition is to understand that some of the difference between short-term and long-term competition. You know, competition is stressful. Long-term stress is maladaptive. It hurts you. It wears you down. It destroys a lot of the hormones that your body needs. But short-term competition, where you train and prepare and then you have a stressful period of time where you're competing, and performance stress can be good for you and can actually help your performance, and then you have rest and recuperation after. So this is really important: training, competition, rest and recuperation. If you never let people rest, you know, endless competition is bad for them. But training, competing, and resting as a cycle is really effective at driving performance and engagement.
So I think from what you just said, we can kind of get an idea, kind of refine what adaptive competition and maladaptive competition looks like. So it sounds like adaptive competition is process focused. It's focused on the training and that you're going to get better through the process. Maladaptive competition is primarily focused on winning or losing.
And not providing rest and recuperation.
Okay.
And not allowing that phase of training where people can creative problem solve their strategies, where they can improve their skill sets that will be drawn upon in the competition. I can with my brother start washing the dishes, you know, at our summer house, and next thing you know, it turns into a competition, you know, and it's fun, right? And you know, when we were kids and we would do that, it could get out of hand, and there's no skill building. I mean, the competition can break out anywhere, anytime, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's good or it's bad. I don't know that we're obsessed with that. I think what we're thinking about here is what is the proper role of competition in our, especially our children's lives, where we're most protective, and then also long term in our regular sort of working lives.
So it sounds like the ancient Greeks and most of humanity has kind of intuitively understood how competition can improve performance. But it wasn't until the 19th century where we started getting scientific about it. Can you tell us about the study that the guy did with, like, I think it was like a rowing machine back in the 1800s, where he found that, competition can actually help improve some individuals' performance?
Right, the very first scientific study, this is guy Triplett, and he created this it's a rowing machine where you didn't pull on an oar, you sort of rotated this thing in a circle. He tried to come up with a unique physical contest that nobody had a pre-skill. Nobody was already good at it. No one was naturally doing this motion. And he tested all sorts of people on this, competing, pushing themselves as hard as they could. And what Ashley and I got drawn to especially was the work he did on children. And he found that, sure enough, you know, if you ask a child to go as fast as you can, push yourself, drive yourself, you know, they would do pretty good. But if you put them in competition with another person, they would do even better for the most part, but not everybody.
I mean, has this research been replicated?
This type of research has been replicated, the premise of it, you know, thousands of times in thousands of different ways in every dimension of our life, that how do people do in competition versus how do they do by just driving themselves. And where this body of science and say where did we go wrong as a society in interpreting this was we would – you know, you'll always see some kids who up in a competition, they do poorly. They don't like it. It's not working for them, and they do far worse than they would be if they just drove themselves. And there was this kind of moral judgment to say, well, then competition is bad, rather than looking more acutely or more granularly at what are all these studies saying about when does competition lead to poorer performance. It's a subset of the results. Why is it happening? What are the conditions? And typically seems to be some form of maladaptive competition. But the most fundamental rule here of all, the one that all of the studies show, is that what works is when it's a fair contest. When, say, going back to those two kids on this rotating rowing machine, that when one kid was up against another kid who was just flat out better and faster, and the kid who wasn't as good felt like she had no chance, she couldn't beat this person, then she would crumble. And interestingly, the person who was really good, unchallenged, you know, coasted. So both of them would do worse. But across all of this body of research, when people feel like it's a fair contest, they tend to do really, really do improve. There's a study about the Air Force Academy that can I tell people about this?
Yeah, I was hoping you'd bring it up.
Here's a modern example of this. So really interesting one. So at the Air Force Academy, I'm kidding, right, maybe about 6 years ago. You know, to get into the Air Force Academy, it's one of our top institutions, and you need to get a letter of recommendation from a congressperson or administrative person, and you have to have good grades. But even then, there are students there, young cadets, who don't survive, and they drop out. And, you know, across the board in the military, their strategy has been of late, like, you know, we used to be proud of the fact that we would cut kids and they would drop out. But now they realize, you know, we need every one of these good kids we can get. And we need to stop, like, these mechanisms that disempower them. We want to find a way to help them all be really good cadets, really good future soldiers, really good people in our society. So these economists had this idea, and they wanted to use these comparative effects, this social effect. And they had this idea. So to me, I call it the J. Edmark effect, because when I was in ninth grade, in eighth grade, there was this kid, J. Edmark, and he was my friend. And his mom, whenever I go to his house, she was always asking him to hang out with Poe because I was a good student and he wasn't a good student. She kept figuring I would rub off on him. And all of my good habits would rub off on him. So a similar idea was conceived of at the Air Force by these economists who were consulting with the Air Force Academy. And they created these platoons, these groups of 30 incoming freshmen, and they paired up like half of these little platoons were students who were at risk because, you know, they were on the bubble and of maybe not succeeding once they got there. And they paired them up with really high performing young cadets. And they thought that just by living in the same dorm, by eating together, by studying together, by training together, that the high performers rub off on the low performers. And they thought this was going to be this magic social effect. And the school year went on, and they started to see some problems right away, and they got worried, but it was an economic experiment, and they were measuring it and doing it. And by the end of the year, they were like, uh-oh, we messed up. And that the low performers had not been rubbed off on by the high performers. They had, like that girl who's doing the rowing machine who collapsed and crumbled, they had withdrawn from the high performers. So they would eat together, but they'd go to the other end of the table. They would study together, but they'd go to a different part of the library. They had moved their bunks. They had sort of protected themselves from this endless comparison to someone for whom they could not really compete. It was not a fair contest, and they'd pulled away. And unfortunately, the Air Force had already seeded essentially next year's dorms, if you will. So they actually did this for 2 years, and the second year's results were just like the first year's. And the reason we know about this study, because, you know, failed studies, you think, well, they never appear in the press or they never appear in the journals, but was that essentially afterwards, they, in order to create these dorms of high performers and low performers, they had to take out the middle performers. And they put all the middle performers, you know, in their own dorms and in their own troops. And what they found over there when they looked at them, almost as an afterthought, was that they had done really well as middle performers over the course of that first year of their freshman year. All of them had a fair contest. On any given day, they could outperform each other because through focus and hard work and extra effort. And so there was almost a sense that on a daily basis, you could outshine your competitors by applying drive and hard work and concentration. And as a result, they had pushed each other up to the level of the high performers, all of them. And that essentially the lesson here is that fair contests where kids literally experience that capacity. You know, we can say forever, it's all about hard work, son. You know, you just got to try, you know, or as I famously, you know, had written in Nurture Shock and New York Magazine years before, you know, praising children to call attention to the role of hard work. Well, you can talk till you're blue in the face. You actually have to give kids a chance to experience it. And that chance is where they literally are kind of like just about even with the other people around them. But if they try harder, if they're like, you know, dad's been saying this for a long time, maybe I'll try it, this hard work stuff. It works. And they make that sort of intrinsic internal connection that that this hard work stuff that everyone's always talking about actually can help you.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box, and I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code MANLINESS at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting it on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. There's a famous Abraham Lincoln quote that goes something like, "Good things come to those who wait." That's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. Thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you can find qualified candidates fast. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/manliness to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Really, so some great insights there about being mindful about the competitions you place yourself in or your kids in. So, I mean, this is not just like, it doesn't have to be like, has to apply to formal competition, but let's say you're trying to improve, I don't know, in your physical fitness in some capacity. You don't want to partner up with a really super fit guy. You want to find someone who's maybe just a little bit better than you or about the same and use him as sort of the benchmark. And that could allow you to see some progress in your life.
Yeah, well, the studies say that, yes, that such pairing will give both people, you know, a fair chance, and there will, both sides will drive each other to more success. You know, if you're paired up with a weightlifting buddy or something, you know, there can be other things there, right? I mean, it's like you may not really be competing, you're just supporting each other, and you know, you got to put in the work and stuff. So people tend to improve in both situations. It's just that when you pair yourself with someone who's sort of your equal, your comrade in arms in some sense, your partner in this, then you get more benefits than any other situation.
And I'm curious, were there any differences between how female cadets or male cadets, or were similar studies like it, and how men and women respond differently to these differences in skill level in terms of competition?
So at the time, the Air Force Academy was about 20% women, and it's going up. And there were no differences there in that situation. But again, that is a self-selected group, right? But there is an enormous body of research around competition and its effect on men and women that are divergent. And I just want to predicate this carefully because I'll kind of give away the ending, which is that these differences between men and women are in fact not really that they're a male or that they're a female. It's just that certain biological characteristics more commonly appear in males and less commonly in females, but they still appear both in males and females. And so where we want to start is with a gene variation called the COMT gene, C-O-M-T, and it codes an enzyme that clears dopamine from the synapses in your brain, and most of our brain, we have these dopamine clearers, these janitors that come in and clean up everything. But in the prefrontal cortex, which evolved most recently for our brains, we don't have the usual mechanism. We have this sort of substitute teacher or substitute janitor and has to come in and do this stuff. And what it does is it actually biologically explains the phenomenon that some people perform poorly under stress. And other people actually need the stress to perform their best. That they actually don't turn it up until, you know, the night before the paper's done or got to make that presentation tomorrow. And this sort of thing that we naturally feel and become aware of in our lives, that some people almost crave this stress and they don't do a good job until the stress is there. This is actually the mechanism for that. And what's happening is, depending on your gene variation, you can have a perfect level of dopamine in your prefrontal cortex in non-stressful situations. But when stress happens, that juices up. And other people, and this is the other half of society, are people who chronically have too low dopamine in their prefrontal cortex. And during stress, that dopamine level goes up now to optimal level. So your brain actually works better under stress. So now, that's really cool, and that's a big parenthetical because I want to bring it back to men and women, right? So actually, estrogen downregulates this COMT gene. So it's especially true that as estrogen cycles over the course of a month, it interacts with this. And what it can mean is that biologically, women can have more of the behaviors of sort of the fundamental default of sort of essentially having too much dopamine. They're flooded with dopamine and their brains don't work as well under stress. And again, this is based on genotypes, so it's all related to the genotypes, and this is not true of all women. There's many other social factors that affect men and women. I think the one that so what they find, this is really interesting, is as sort of a consequence, is that this also affects essentially how rational people's brains are at different times. And so all these studies show that, like, female financial analysts on Wall Street studying literally like every single financial estimate made by an analyst for 20 years on every single stock in every single industry show that female financial analysts are on average about 8% better than male financial analysts. Women are better at seeing the risks than men are. Men are better at ignoring the risks. So this even relates to, say, when we know as a society we want far more women to, you know, run for office. So what the studies slowly, the science is teased out, because they look at like every state and they look at who campaigns in these states, they look at judges and races. I mean, these scholars do a really good job looking at all this stuff. And what they find is that women, when they see that the odds of winning are poor, they don't enter the race. When they see the odds of winning are possible, and not even like great, but just possible, they enter the race more than men do. Men are really good at ignoring the odds. Men are willing to say, people say, you know, there's no chance you'll win, and be like, screw it, I'm entering anyway. Like, that's the classic guy response, you know, and we heroize that, but it actually comes down to this like fundamental biology about how we assess risk. And what makes a race most give, what's the one thing that changes a race from you kind of not having a chance to having a chance? It's whether there's an incumbent in place. And incumbents, you know, tend to win political races about 90% of the time in the United States across all categories. And so when the incumbents are no longer running, you'll see far more women in a race because they are judging that they have a chance. Men will enter races regardless of the odds of winning. And so this is kind of interesting. You can't hear this stuff without thinking, well, how does that affect, say, startup culture or startups, where the odds of succeeding in a startup might be 1 in 3 or 1 in 10 to get a 10x return. That the fact that essentially women are smarter about this may be a factor influencing essentially the supply of female entrepreneurs. And if, and it's, I'm not saying that like that's permanent by any means. It's not permanent by a long shot, but it is about culture and support. So people need to understand that they have a chance. Otherwise, they'll evaluate these on their own.
That's really interesting. I'm curious. So, I mean, I understand that, you know, being risk sensitive can play out in the long, but are there any advantages for being risk naive? Because, I mean, obviously men have it. We've had it for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. There has to be a benefit to it, or else we wouldn't have it. So, I mean, what is the adaptive reason why men are risk naive?
So again, I want to be careful about overgeneralizing here, because sure, I know this is a sensitive thing. So, but at this point, it's important to say that when we say men are this, women are this, we should probably stop at this point, because there are plenty of female entrepreneurs. And so basically what I'm talking about here is a phenomenon that on average men this and on average women that. For any particular male or female, one-third of women have this capacity to essentially ignore risk, and two-thirds of men. Okay, so this capacity to sort of try it anyway and believe in yourself and grind it out and disprove the odds, that's something that two-thirds of men and one-third of women have biologically. And this accurate risk sensitivity is a biological construct that two-thirds of women have and one-third of men. And so it's an interaction of certain genes. It's actually, bizarrely, this is actually something that is wired in at fetus stage at about 2 months into the fetal cycles. And those same hormones that act upon that deep part of the brain and spinal cord, and they also do other things. So one of the literally they impact, like those same hormones impact how long your fingers are. So you can do studies that measure the length of fingers among Italian entrepreneurs, and you'll find that the one-third of the entrepreneurs are women, and they'll have a finger length set of traits that, as do the men, that is something that is established 2 months into their fetal development.
This is the 2D 4D ratio, right?
Yeah.
Right. Another aspect of thinking about or being intentional about competition is the size of the competitive pool. And I think you highlighted research where you found that as the competitive pool increases, the competitive drive decreases in people. Because, I mean, it makes sense. There's less of a chance. If there's more people in there, there's less of a chance that you can win. So I'm curious. I mean, this is, I think, an important thing to think about in our globalized, hyper-connected economy where we're hypothetically competing now with millions of other people, not just in your state or even in your country, but around the world. So how do you maintain that competitive fire in such a large competitive pool? I mean, I can see a lot of people say, wow, it's not even worth trying. I'll just kind of be mediocre my life because there's no way I can beat those startups in India or China or Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there's the and you know, or think of those who've taken the ACT or the SAT. You know, listeners would have had that, largely had that experience. And if you sit there going, you know, you get there that test and you're like, man, every student in the country is taking this test today, and I have to compete against all of them. It's really demotivating, and it demotivates you and has certain biological consequences in both in the long term and in the short term, right? And even in the short term, just thinking that way will tune up your brain's fear networks. It will tune down your brain's reward networks. It will tweak the ratio of noradrenaline to adrenaline, which is like to perform, you want to get a really certain ratio there. It will affect your blood pressure. It will affect your vasoconstriction, vasodilation, and your body's capacity to sort of convert fuel into energy. And just by thinking about it differently. And then you will suffer poorer performance just because you think of it that way. You know, what works, I mean, to take like taking the ACT or SAT, like what works is to say, you know, is to challenge a friend or challenge a cousin or challenge somebody to say, hey, you and I are going to compete. We both took that test. We both did okay. We're going to see who can improve their score by more. And if you focus your competition, you can improve. And in this landscape of our globalized world, that same mechanism works, that you want to focus your efforts on beating so-and-so, this other, you know, startups work because they are typically in a space where there are a lot, just like there's always coming out of Hollywood, two movies about Mars at the same time, two movies about the White House blowing up at the same time. You know, you're like, startups are in the same way. There's startups in your space and you're competing with them. And if you focus your efforts on them, you tend to do really well. One of the most fascinating industries where we saw this pattern was in Italy. The industry that makes, not packages, but they make the machinery that makes packaging. So the way we get pharmaceuticals, or the way we get blister packs, or the clamshells around cell phones, I mean, all these things have been invented as this new packaging, and they come from all these newfangled packaging machines. And if you turn back the clock 15 years, Germany really dominated the packaging machine industry, and Italy was a much smaller player. But in this very small region of Italy outside Bologna, there are about 200 packaging machines, and they're not all competing with each other. Inside that industry of where there's 200 packaging machine companies, and they make these, you know, these huge machines are the size of a room that cost, you know, $400,000, but they will churn out all sorts of modern packaging. In cosmetics, there's four companies, and they know who each other are, and they are fiercely competitive. And they can go to dinner in Bologna and they can be like, yeah, there's the guy who just came up with that new thing that the machine can do, and that's everybody's buying it and it's great. And so through intense local rivalries, the people in those companies were passionate, were knowledgeable, their status was at stake, and they drove themselves to succeed by emphasizing local rivalry. And in the process, they went from being a small player in this global market to the dominant player in this global market. And so it's important to think less globally when you're competing, and instead to think more about, you know, who's your rival. Think of sports, look at Nike and Adidas are rivals, and they're pushing each other, and they're doing great while through that rivalry, while smaller other companies like Fila and stuff have sort of had to step aside. In sports, we see historic rivalries that push teams to sort of figure out how to get better, how to reach that next level. So the lesson for us is to sort of think locally here. Think more about our rivals. Think about our direct competitors.
All right. So I think there's some really two good insights we've hit so far. So the first one was, if you're going to compete, make sure the competition level is at a parity, right? You don't want to compete with someone too high. And then also you want to narrow your field of competition. You know, if you have to do that psychologically, right? Instead of thinking about every kid in America is taking the SAT or I'm competing with every other, you know, software developer in the world, you think about, I'm just going to compete against these, you know, few dozen that I know, and I'm going to try to best them as best I can.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go back to this biology, because I think the biology stuff is really interesting. We've hit a few of the things already. You talked about how testosterone actually makes people more cooperative in order to be more competitive. We've talked about the COMT gene and its influence on dopamine. So let's talk about the process of what happens to our physiology as we prepare for competition, what happens during competition, and then what happens afterwards, whether we win or lose, and why we have those responses.
So I think the best way to approach this is, let's get back to how we as a society, so I'm going to come at this, but I'm going to talk about stress. I'm going to talk about how we as a society label stress, and we have a – even more so than we are down on competition, we are really down on stress. We make a broad sweeping connection between stress and poor performance. People say, hey, honey, how was your day? I wasn't very good. I was stressed. You know, how was your test? I was stressed. Stress taking reduces performance. And we go like, oh yeah, well, what's wrong with that? Of course, it's what it does. Like we just accept it. And so let me tell you about the work of Jeremy Jameson. He's done this work starting, we did it with Harvard students who were preparing for the GRE exam, where they're really competitive about what elite academic program they're going to get into for graduate school. And he's also reproduced at the other end of the spectrum with community college students in Michigan. And the paradigm's the same. I'll just talk about the Harvard students for a second, but they come in and they take and the GRE is computerized test now. So the first thing they get is they spit in a cup and they're told their saliva is going to be measured for different hormones and stuff. And they read a page and half the students read a page that says, you know, this is a study on the connection between stress and performance. And the others read that, and then they also continue to read a paragraph that says, new science is questioning whether stress is bad for performance, and it may in fact even help you. We don't really know, but when you're taking this test, if you're feeling stressful, it's an open question whether it's going to help you or not. And they took the test, and the kids who got that prompt, who were told that stress might help them performance, performed 50 points higher out of 800 on the GRE just from reading that. And when they took the actual GRE, they actually scored 65 points higher months later. And they hadn't continued to be taught this. They just taught it once. And now, so you might think, I get it. See here, here's what happened. You told them that don't stress out about your stress. You told them your stress isn't bad for you. So, you know, you essentially tricked them to not be stressed. But that was, in fact, not the case. They had taken their saliva levels and they had tested them for alpha amylase and cortisol. And they found that these students were, in fact, truly stressed and more stressed. It was how their body interpreted stress. See, if we label it as a bad thing, we are actually harming our students, ourselves, every time. There is a very big difference here between long-term stress and short-term stress. Short-term performance stress can be harnessed to help you, not to hurt you. And constantly panicking about, like, stress of competition is undermining kids because it's labeling short-term stress as wrong. Stress, those physiological symptoms are actually your body loading up with lots of energy because it knows this moment of competition has happened. And we interpret it often as nausea or as anxiety. But if you interpret it as energy loading to prepare, you will actually perform better. And the what I was describing to you in kind of a previous question about how the way we mentally conceive of stress triggers our vagal nerves that instantly change the ratio of noradrenaline to adrenaline, which affects out throughout the entire skeletal structure of our body. The vasodilation versus vasoconstriction, which affects energy capacities and especially tunes up the reward networks or tunes up the fear networks. All of that is that physiology is moderated by how you conceive of stress. And that if you can conceive of short-term stress as pumping you up, as gearing you up, as readying you for competition, you will perform better. And you can actually harness your stress to perform your best. And remember that that's true regardless of the comp gene. But remember that already, if you need a little bolus of a pat on the back here, remember that, because the comp gene is evenly distributed in our society, a quarter of us fully need stress to perform our best. Intellectually, we think better under stress. And another half of us at least have a gene, of at least one of the two genes for that. We would have got it from our mother or our father. So a lot of us can really benefit from this. But in fact, what I'm describing as sort of the way that the mind controls the physiology, that's true of all of us. And we need to change as a society how we think of short-term stress. And differentiate, parse it like the Greeks, to the distinction between short-term stress that's predicated with training. I knew I had a presentation. I was working so hard on that presentation. I knew I was going to have to give it. I knew it would be stressful, but I prepared. And then there was the moment of performance, and I nailed it. And then afterward, rest and recuperation. And if you give yourself those cycles, you can really do amazing work in that moment.
What do you do if you have the comp gene where you crumble under pressure? Like, how should you approach the competitive process that way?
So it's a great question, because when I would speak at, say, schools about this, many parents sit there thinking, and I mean, sometimes they're almost in tears. They're kind of interpreting this like, wow, it's my kid's physical, physiology. It's her biology. It's his biology that must be the case, that my kid really is not wired for stress. And they feel like it's fatalistic, like there's nothing I can do about it. And their natural quick thinking strategy is towards, well, I need to make sure then for my kid to learn that they need to not be in a stressful situation, to not have to deal with any sort of performance stress at all. And, you know, when the time comes, maybe I won't even have him take the SAT, you know, because it's just there's no my kid has no chance because of this sort of biological fatalism. No scientist who works in this field actually agrees with that. That is a sort of an adaptive response. What they all note is that, you know, our brains learn and we have many layers of systems. And what's really important to do is to train up our stress management systems and our stress control systems. So it's the same way I was describing that it's true for everybody, no matter what level of type of competition you have, that if you think about short-term stress as performance enhancing, you can leverage it. It's important to inoculate kids to the stress response. And to inoculate them, it means to stress them without overwhelming them. And to understand the difference. And if you can adaptively train kids to cope with stress but not to overwhelm them, their strength, their stress management systems in their body and in their mind will improve. Their mind will learn how to activate these certain networks to control this stuff. Simplest example, this is going to sound amazing, but you can tell with a certain neural scan which kids are going to be shy at about 9 months old in their life. And you see a certain brain reaction. And by the time they're about six, you will see, and certainly by 10, you will see that about half of those kids, even though they are sort of biologically predisposed to be really shy, have learned to master and control that response and tune it down. I was one of those kids. I was perversely shy until I was about 6 years old. My son also had this same neural signature for sure. Neither of us would you think of as shy. We've learned through our sort of stress management systems to calm that response. And so in the same way, it's really important to empower, to inoculate, to strengthen these sort of stress management systems so that they don't undermine you. Sure, there's going to be situations where you can't control that and you're going to have that sort of negative comp gene thing. You're going to be overloaded and you need to de-stress in those points to perform your best. No question. And some people won't, you know, they're never going to turn themselves into someone who really needs stress to perform their best. They're still going to be the kind of person who, without stress, they perform their best, but maybe even under stress, they can still do well.
Right. So it sounds like practicing in stressful situations. So like if you're practicing for the SAT, like do it under like time restrictions, or if you have a fear of public speaking, like, you know, slowly build up an audience until you can sort of manage that stress that you will have. So just a lot of practice, it sounds like, is the remedy or part of the remedy.
Let me just be really clear. Look, I did great on the SAT, right? I have the genetic profile that's going to help me in those moments. But the SAT is the worst form of competition anyone's ever had. It's the dumbest thing ever. You cannot prepare for the stress of the SAT. You only take it, you know, once or twice in your life. There's no training for it. But most of all, it's just badly competition designed. Because, let's see, when I put my kid on a swim team, even if she doesn't win, I'm like, she made friends, she got activities, she was outside, you know, she had mentors, she had coaching, she learned the value of hard work, you know, she became a better swimmer, she got some, you know, white ribbons, we had some birthday cake. You know, there's all these good reasons to be in the pool that aren't just about winning. But nobody ever comes out of the SAT and says to their friend, you know, I bombed, but I really made a lot of friends at the Kaplan Center. It's the only competition where the only thing that matters is the final score, and that is not a good competition. Nobody ever says, you know, I crumped in there. I scored terrible, I'm sure. But I learned a lot of vocabulary in all of my training that's going to help me long term. That would be the approach, which is that winning or losing, you got better. No, this is a competition where the only thing that matters is the final score, and that is by default a maladaptive competition. Now, should we have SATs or not? Well, SATs are going to be a test that benefits those who have the biological predisposition to handle that kind of performance stress. On the other hand, if you got rid of them, all of the rest of it is a system designed to biologically to favor those who biologically don't have that system. Either way, we're kind of screwed. And so we need to balance these things fairly. We need to understand and recognize that we need to have systems in place that some kids who score poorly on that kind of stuff nevertheless can be great, brilliant students. And vice versa. There are people who don't do great all year long. They don't do amazing stuff, but when they have to write that paper or when they do take that standardized test, they ace it. And that's showing you sort of them at their best. And in this way, both types of students can show you what's at their best. But I cannot defend the SAT. Let me just make it clear. It's a competition where the only thing that matters is the final score.
Right, right. Well, hey, Poe, this has been a great conversation, and there's a lot more we can delve into. So I'm going to recommend everyone go check out the book Top Dogs. But where can people find out about your latest works? I think you mentioned earlier, before the conversation, that you're doing a lot of research about the future of sport.
Yeah, so the last 2 years, we've set up an editorial team, and we're doing work on the future of sports. And you can find that on Twitter at Future of, or on the website at futureof.org, and it'll take you to the sports report. We do this with cooperation with 62 professional teams, and it's been really fun. I think there's a lot of – it's not that a lot of technology is so much going to change sports as it is this, that a lot of change is coming to our, all of our society as a result of new technologies. Sports is an interesting prism by which to look at these and to get used to some of these new technologies and to think about it. And it's fun. So futureof.org is where you can find the future of sports.
Fantastic. Well, Poe Bronson, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett.
My guest today was Poe Bronson. He's the author of the book Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. You can find it on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, check out his website, PoeBronson.com, for more information about his work. And also check out the show notes at aom.is/topdog, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. And we appreciate your reviews on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick scented oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.